The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Thank you, and happy, happy Easter. All right.
Wait. Okay, so I'm going to quickly read Brown Bear, so you're all not soaking wet.
And they're not going to let me read it all.
I'll let you. Here, you can start us off. Can you? Oh, here.
Can I read backwards?
Read the first page. Go ahead.
Brown Bear, what do you see? I see a bird looking at me. Now you got it.
All right. Okay, just stay.
She tell me, just sit, don't move. She's a teacher.
I'm the teacher, you know.
Pakistan should not, and Afghanistan should be people's.
All the Easter Bunny, Mr. President.
All the Easter Bunny. Happy President.
At one point, a journalist tried to ask the president a question about Afghanistan. When he tried to answer, he was saved by the Easter Bunny, who startled the president, but successfully led him away from the press corps. Turns out that was the White House director of message planning, Megan Hayes, in the bunny suit.
And the New York Post is saying this morning she's considered by a lot of the journalists there at the White House, and Peter might know this, as being responsible for limiting press access to Biden at public events over the last year.
Exhibit A.
Right. How embarrassing is that? And for him to listen, who's in control here? Who's it, in all seriousness? She embarrassed the president. This is seen everywhere around the world. This is why Saudi Arabia's version of SNL is mocking him as a doddering old man being led by the vice president, which is actually
inaccurate. Hundreds of thousands of people watch.
So she's hurting. She is hurting him.
That, of course, was footage from over the weekend where you had Joe Biden's handlers in constant motion. Just to tell him what he could and couldn't do. I thought it was interesting, as was brought out there, that in the bunny suit is the director of message planning. She's the one that limits the access that the media have in asking questions to this illegitimate president. I mean, it's so obvious, as we've noted so many times, and particularly here in the last few weeks, but really, tomorrow's news today, it was right there in the Trumpet. Early on with this illegitimate administration, the fact that this is Barack Obama's third term, it's really pretty sad, though, and pathetic to see this older man in obvious cognitive decline and everyone covering for him, including his own wife. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. We certainly appreciate you joining our growing audience. You can get to the live stream of our program through CRN Digital Talk Radio, Channel 3 on that platform. To get to the live video stream of this show, however, you have to go to our very own website. That would be thetrumpet.com. Just go to thetrumpet.com/live. Takes you right to the live stream page. And you can also get to the podcast that we post after the fact, should you listen on demand or view on demand. And more of our listeners, our viewers, are becoming exactly that. They're viewing the program, lots to see with all of the video clips that we're able to play each day on the show. But the whole world is watching this. Kilmeade there at the Fox show, he mentioned, I didn't show the footage last week, this Saudi Arabian TV show, just mocking the president of the United States. And when America's weak, when America's presidency is weak, as this one is, it just invites aggression coming from enemy nations. That's just the way that it works. It's the way it's always been. There's a few now commenting. I think Zero Hedge has a story on this ongoing severe lockdown in China Shanghai in particular. Let me just give to you a quote from CNN. It says nearly 400 million people across 45 cities in China are under full or partial lockdown as part of China's strict zero COVID policy. It says together they represent 40% of annual gross domestic product for the world's second largest economy. And so one wonders, what is China doing? Why is China hurting itself this way? And really, we don't know all of the reasons behind it. We know, though, that this is the nation that created the virus, and with the help of Fauci and company, of course. But the virus came out of China. Let me just read to you what my father has written. This is at thetrumpet.com. I forget which issue this was from. Oh boy, I lost it in my notes. How did I get confused already? Page 7. If I can get to page 8, it has a trumpet quote about the virus coming out from China. In any event, let me finish the CNN quote. Maybe I can find page 8 here in a second. But it says here, analysts are ringing warning bells, but say investors aren't properly assessing how serious the global economic fallout might be from these prolonged isolation orders. It says the quarantines have led to food shortages, inability to access medical care, and even reported pet killings. It says they've also left the largest port in the world understaffed. Listen to this. It says the port of Shanghai, which handled over 20% of Chinese freight traffic in 2021, is essentially at a standstill. So the Shanghai port, 20%. I mean, it's at a standstill. And I guess my question is, would China, do you think the CCP in China would hurt its own people and even its own economy if it knew that it could further cripple the United States? The United States, of course, going into all of the lockdown mania in 2020, as you know from the last few months or the last year or two of the Trump presidency, I mean, the economy in the United States was just humming along on all cylinders. And then comes Fauci and company. And then comes the lockdown. And, of course, a lot of nations in the West were quite happy to go into full lockdown. Now you have a lot of these Western nations. You had the big announcement yesterday from so many of these airlines. We're doing away with these mask mandates. I'll get to that a little bit later. But would China hurt its own people and its own economy to further cripple the United States? We're already... In the last 15 months, what have we seen? We've seen skyrocketing inflation. We've seen money just being printed, trillions and trillions of dollars. And the cost for everything going up. And this is that quote. It's from, was the coronavirus crisis engineered? It's from the Trumpet magazine. It says here, the communists covered up the virus's true origins and turned what should have been a local outbreak into a global pandemic. So when they could have protected the rest of the world, when they could have protected the other nations of the world and had their own lockdown back in 2020 or even before that in late 2019, they didn't do it. They spread the virus around the world. And now 2 years on, and Western nations are finally saying, okay, enough. We've got to open up our economies again. We've got to open up our nations. And now you have the CCP imposing this kind of a lockdown on Shanghai and other cities, affecting hundreds of millions of Chinese people, but also these ports. And we're already in the midst of a supply chain crisis. My father says here, we must take seriously the theory that all this was deliberate. We cannot just push it aside. It says this is the Communist Party of China we're talking about. It's trying to get control of the world. China wants to get control of the world. And so you wouldn't put it past them to try to hurt the world, even if it means hurting its own people. This is from Melanie Phillips. She's writing about the Joe Biden administration and how they're trying to resurrect this Iran nuclear deal. As I say, the whole world is watching the doddering old man. Obama, of course, is behind the scenes as the puppet master. We know this. But from Melanie Phillips, she's talking about this depraved administration. She writes here, just consider the implications of this. The killing of Soleimani, I guess, as part of the deal. As part of the deal, the United States evidently is saying, look, we'll remove you or your army from, the terrorist network or labeling that it a terrorist group. So long as you won't come after those that were responsible for taking out Soleimani. And Iran is saying, no way. No way. We want a better deal than that. They're the ones calling the shots. It's just crazy. It says, a welcome and long overdue lethal counterstrike by the U.S. against the man who had the blood of countless Americans, speaking of Soleimani, countless Americans and others on his hands, and who was the Iranian regime's most important strategist of mass murder. It says, yet instead of making good on this tardy defense of the West by doubling down on such counterstrikes, the Biden team proceeded to grovel before the godfathers of terror in Tehran in a sordid plea for protection against reprisals for Soleimani's killing in exchange for giving a free pass to the terrorist army he had commanded, thus putting the lives of countless more innocents at risk from IRGC atrocities. Melanie Phillips says here, worse still, the Biden team is apparently now considering an Iranian proposal that would enable the regime not to publicly close the file on taking revenge for Soleimani. It would appear from this that the Biden team is now considering agreeing to an Iranian proposal to take some kind of revenge on the U.S. And this despite the IRGC plot to murder John Bolton and Pompeo. This is another story we just haven't taken the time to get into. But here is this number one state sponsor of terror. And they're continuing on sponsoring all of these terrorist atrocities. And the United States just groveling before them, the mullahs in Tehran. She quotes from this Lee Smith article that we looked into last week. And says here in conclusion, the only way to describe this is, as Smith suggests, depraved. It's what happens when wicked people lure others with no courage and even less moral sense down the rabbit hole of wishful thinking. It says they end up becoming complicit in depravity. And this is now the trajectory that America, the ostensible leader of the free world, this is the trajectory America is on, says Melanie Phillips. And so, as I've been saying, as we've said at the Trumpet, it's worse. It's much, much worse than in incompetence or America being led by a leader who's in cognitive decline. It's an attack from within as well. An attack from within. And the enemies from without, they're making their moves, whether it's China or Iran, Russia. They're on the march. They're on the march. And so here is the fake president of the United States being directed by the bunny, of all things. Told where to go by the bunny. He's over there talking about Afghanistan. And then here comes the director of message planning. And, I mean, she doesn't like that at all. She's got to get him away from the crowd. They've got to tell him what he can read, when he can read. They tell him to sit down, to stay there. They tell him to wave. They tell him this. They tell him that because he doesn't know what he's doing. Listen to Sean Hannity. This was from his show last evening, clip two.
I'm looking at somebody. Somebody needs to step in here because everybody in that White House knows that he's in far worse shape than we even know. They knew it during the campaign. They know it now. And the weakness abroad is hurting the country. Because our adversaries, our enemies also see what we see. They see a president in a massive, precipitous cognitive decline.
And the American people see this. It's very clear now, Sean. And this is a scary, scary poll result. ABC News, Washington Post, they found that a majority of this country, 54% of voters, believe that Joe Biden doesn't have the mental sharpness to lead the country effectively. That is scary stuff.
54%, he says there. 54% of Americans see it. And then, as Hannity brought out, our adversaries see it as well. This is from The Federalist. It says here, it's a serious question. Who is in charge? Who's in charge of the United States of America? We know it isn't Joe Biden. And although his wife had the reins on Sunday, we know the First Lady's power is extremely limited. It probably isn't the person in the bunny suit either. We also know it isn't Kamala Harris, who, despite being decades his junior, can't string together a more coherent sentence than he can, and seems to be largely shielded from the administration's pet policy work in true Veep fashion. It says, it isn't White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, who gets schooled by Fox News' Peter Doocy on a near daily basis and is rumored to be leaving her post for MSNBC. Who's in charge of the United States is an important question, and this isn't a laughing matter. All of our foreign adversaries are watching this and licking their chops. All of our foreign adversaries, they're watching, they're observing, they're licking their chops, as it says here. Weakness invites aggression, as we've already seen with Russia's advance on Ukraine and the systematic destruction of the U.S. southern border. So here we are, more than 330 million people, ostensibly in the hands of a president who's being ushered around by an Easter bunny, with no idea who's actually in charge around here. Here again, tomorrow's news today. The Trumpet magazine, October of 2021. This is six, seven, 8 months ago. My father says here, many people can clearly see that Joe Biden is not really in charge of the government. He has filled his administration with Obama-era officials, and Mr. Obama himself is really directing the show. Some say correctly that this is effectively Obama's third term. Obama's the one directing the show. Jack Posobiec tweeted out today that Biden has reportedly told Obama that he wants to run again in 2024. I think a better tweet might have been he's asked Obama if he can run again in 2024. Look at the handlers. Look at how they humiliated Joe Biden when Barack Obama visited the White House a week or two back. And then on Sunday for the bunny to come along and to shoo away the President of the United States. Who's in charge? That's what the Federalist is asking. Who is in charge? Who's running the show? Well, if you read The Trumpet, you know. This is from a few weeks back at our website. After Biden finished his speech praising Obama for being the main force to personally push through Obamacare, the crowd swarmed around him, Obama, not Biden. Biden, supposedly the most powerful man in America and the leader of the free world, wandered aimlessly around the room with no one to talk to and staring at the ceiling. Some of you may have seen the footage. I believe it was from Friday, where the fake president finished his speech and then turned around to shake hands with nobody. No one was there. He put his hand out. He held it there to shake the hand of no one. It says here, this is our Trumpet piece. One former Trump official captioned video of the event, Biden the bystander, at his own party. At one point, he tried to get Obama's attention repeatedly. Remember when Biden was trying to pull at Barack Obama's shoulder, calling out, Barack, Barack! And Obama, of course, just ignored him. Finally grabbing his shoulder, holding onto it for a while Obama still pointedly ignored him for a bit and continued talking to the group that had gathered around him. It says, even with the revelations of Biden's corruption again coming to light from his son's laptop, it still is sad to see a senile old man being upstaged by the real fake president of the United States. That's the article that we posted following the White House event. Who is in charge? There was a piece at the New York Times posted last night. I think it's on the front page of the paper, the print version of the paper, this morning, talking about the election. November of 2020, I mean, we're what, 17, 18 months on from that? And here's the New York Times talking about this group of Republicans that just won't let it go. They're just convinced that the election was stolen. It says here, now some of these same confidants, speaking of Trump Republicans, who tried and failed to invalidate the results based on a set of bogus legal theories, are pushing an even wilder sequel that by decertifying the 2020 vote in key states, the outcome can still be reversed. The New York Times, it's just beside itself. How can this be possible? How can they still be trying to reverse it? Says here in state houses and courtrooms across the country, as well as on right-wing news outlets, allies of Mr. Trump, including the lawyer, John Eastman, are pressing for states to pass resolutions rescinding Electoral College votes for President Biden and to bring lawsuits that seek to prove baseless claims of large-scale voter fraud. The Times, of course, can't help itself. Has to inject its editorializing, baseless claims about voter fraud, claims that the New York Times and others refuse to look into, refuse to consider. It says some of those allies are casting their work as a precursor to reinstating the former president. It says the efforts have failed to change any statewide outcomes or uncover mass election fraud. It says legal experts dismiss them as preposterous, noting that there is no plausible scenario under the Constitution for returning Mr. Trump to office. And yet, here comes the New York Times still reporting. It just won't go away, will it? If it's so preposterous, if nobody really believes that it happened, that the election was stolen, then why on the front page of the New York Times are they coming after this again, trying to discredit those that would say, yes, it was stolen? You know about Dinesh D'Souza's movie that's coming out in a couple weeks, 2,000 mules. These mules that went out and they just hauled in thousands upon thousands of fake votes. It's perfect for the times we're in. All this fake news, a fake administration, fake ballots. Listen to Rachel Maddow. Here again, the media are still in full meltdown mode over those that would dare question the results of November 3rd, 2020. This is clip 7.
Just as the New York Times posted this story about how the Trump folks, including at least one Trump lawyer, John Eastman, are continuing, even now, in their efforts to try to get various states to retroactively decertify the results of the 2020 presidential election in order to get Trump declared the winner of that election instead, in order to get him reinstated into the White House now. This is not old news. This is not a rerun. Apparently, they are still working on this now, still in Wisconsin, in Arizona, in Georgia, in Michigan. They're trying to get the Electoral College tally in each of those states decertified.
Wisconsin. She lists off the states. There, you don't hear much about it, but there are efforts, movements in some of these swing states to decertify. Yes, even now, still, a year and a half after they stole it. This is from that New York Times article. It says, but just as Mr. Eastman's original plan to use Congress's final count of electoral votes on January 6, 2021 to overturn the election was seen as far-fetched in the run-up to the deadly Capitol riot. So you read this. And here again, what have we noted at the trumpet? How that January 6th was part of the plan. It was part of the plan to cover up the steal. They knew it would be contested. They knew there would be protests. They had the trial run with the Whitmer kidnapping. And they sent the guy over the Detroit office at the FBI. They sent him to D.C., and he's the one that presided over the insurrection hoax. You see how closely these two are related, more and more. Now, articles like this, of course, don't state it that way. But you piece it all together. This is going to be brought out in the America Under Attack book, the one that we're updating and revising. I think it's something like 50 or 60,000 words at the moment. And some editing left to be done on that one, but it's going to be quite the book. Quite an explosive. The title itself is explosive. It's going to become one of our most popular publications, if not the most. America Under Attack. We've got the smaller version somewhere here. Here it is. America Under Attack. That's right. It's no problem for them to launder ballots. They did it. They had all the pack mules. I read you the story yesterday from Zuckerberg. He's been fully exposed, so he's going to lay low for a while. We're not going to donate $300-400 million to Fulton County and some of these other counties, Maricopa, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, those areas. We're going to lay low a little bit because there was a lot of cheating. They know it. It's kind of like the survey on Biden's competency or whether or not he's cognitively able to serve as president. A majority of Americans know it. It says here, the run-up to the deadly Capitol riot. Yeah, it was deadly, all right. They shot the Trump supporter, remember that. And then the others, the so-called officers that died at the Capitol riot didn't even die at the riot. They died later. And they're all being counted as victims. And then they don't care about the ramming that happened in April of last year, where you had the black nationalist actually kill a Capitol Hill police officer. That gets covered up. It's not part of the narrative. It says here, they are keeping alive the same combustible stew of conspiracy theory and misinformation that threatens to undermine faith in democracy by nurturing the lie that the election was corrupt. So this is the great threat to democracy by saying that the election was stolen. It says the efforts have fed a cottage industry of podcasts and television appearances centered around not only false claims of widespread election fraud in 2020, but the notion that the results can still be altered after the fact. And Mr. Trump returned to power, an idea that he continues to push privately as he looks toward a probable re-election run in 2024. I mean, they still think Trump can come back. These crazies, these kooks, these conspiracy theorists. Who are the real conspiracy theorists, though? Here again is Rachel Maddow from her show last night, clip 8.
Trump himself is reportedly encouraging it, while of course insisting that everybody in Republican politics has to repeat his claims that the election wasn't valid and he should rightfully still be in the White House. Him wanting that is one thing. The fact that Republicans, almost without exception, really are going along with it is another. As noted in the Times tonight, quote, elected Republicans have almost uniformly embraced Trump's claims that the vote was stolen.
So she's going through the New York Times article. I guess it was posted just before her show last night. The article says, though, Democrats and some Republicans have raised deep concerns about the impact of the decertification efforts. They warn of unintended consequences, including the potential to incite violence of the sort that erupted on January 6th. In other words, if you look into this, this could lead to another insurrection. This could lead to more violence like we saw on January 6th. We've never seen anything like it, except maybe the Civil War. There's the Civil War, and then there's January 6th. It says, when a mob of Mr. Trump's supporters, convinced that he could still be declared the winner of the 2020 election, stormed the Capitol, legal experts worry that the focus on decertifying the last election could pave the way for far more aggressive and earlier legislative intervention the next time around. So here again, the potential for violence. What might happen? That's what we've got to be concerned about. Never mind looking at the evidence of election fraud. That's got to be covered up. That's got to be stamped out. That's got to be blotted out. And you know how intense the effort has been to try to blot out that message. And yet, here comes the New York Times front page story today in the print edition, laying out all of these states where the results are still being contested. and where you've got Trump supporters who still believe he's coming back even before 2024. And as I say, you read through it and you see how that January 6th was all part of the plot. It's all part of the coup. Julie Kelly, she's had some questions regarding the Whitmer kidnapping hoax. Remember, those two were acquitted just a couple weeks ago. I think it was two Fridays ago. And basically it was the FBI who tried to set them up. It says here, consider this exchange between Richard, this is from Julie Kelly, from Richard Trask, one of the lead FBI agents on the case, who was later fired by the agency for assaulting his wife, working out of the Detroit field office, and a defense attorney during the October 2020 hearing after the defendants were arrested. So this is an exchange between an attorney and Trask. It says, now, the attorney says, now, when this, since you had undercover agents involved in this case, I assume that there's additional steps that are taken at the FBI to approve an undercover operation, right? And Trask says, that's correct. The agents, FBI agents, don't just show up as part of this plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan. That's what the attorney's getting at. It was planned, right? From the top. Yes, it was. The attorney says, it's not as if you can just declare that you're conducting an undercover operation on your own. You need supervisor approval at least, right? Correct, says Trask. The attorney says, and then it probably even goes to the headquarters level, right? Trask says, that's correct. It says, and FBI headquarters would then meet with the Department of Justice and review the plan and the objectives, right? That would be correct, yes. It goes all the way up to the top, in other words. If the FBI, if they're working undercover on something as high profile as kidnapping a sitting governor of the United States of America, the state of Michigan, well, it must be known among the higher-ups at the DOJ, at the FBI. Yeah, absolutely, of course. How much more so, January 6th? All these FBI agents, the Ray Epps guy, all these others that have been exposed in videos circulating on social media. How many higher-ups would have known all about the January 6th hoax and how they were setting up and working to frame Donald Trump supporters, people that just went there to support Donald Trump? He was, after all, still president at that time, January 6th. And it was constitutionally lawful for these senators and congresspeople to contest the results that each state had turned in. They were going to look into the evidence. But all of that, you see, all of that was covered up because of this so-called violent mob. The New York Times piece on, this is just the last quote, on all of these efforts to decertify. It says, at the moment, there's no other way to say it. There's quoting some bigwig here. There's no other way to say it. This is the clearest and most present danger to our democracy. Everything. Anyone that would question what these radical communists say and do, anyone that would question it, you're against democracy. It says here, Trump and his supporters in Congress and in the states are preparing now to lay the groundwork to overturn the election in 2024, were Trump or his designee to lose the vote for the presidency. So they're already stealing 2024. 2020 was perfect. They stole 2016. They're going to steal 2024. These people, I mean, the message that they project, they're so guilty. They can't help but to say the quiet part out loud or to come out with these kinds of stories a year and a half later. They know what they did. And they know that any effort to get these state legislatures to just get it back to the way the rules used to be applied is going to prevent them from stealing it again. And so you can see a lot if you read between the lines, or if you listen between the lines of Rachel Maddow, you know that they're gravely concerned. Are they going to be able to steal it again? What happens after the red wave of this November? This is why they're in the meltdown mode that they're in. I'll just have to maybe come back to the lifting of the mask mandate. You know, and what's interesting about this story is just how quickly it just took one judge to finally stand up to it in Florida. And she said, enough. And then the TSA, all the airlines, they come out immediately. Some of them made the announcement while the planes were in flight. And then you've got all these images on social media of people cheering, clapping. Finally, they're playing Celebration, the song. And, of course, the Biden administration coming out saying, no, 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 we recommend that you still wear a mask. Except at White House events, of course. I'll come to that maybe at a later time. We're quickly running out of time on today's show. You're listening to Stephen Fleury. This is the Trumpet Daily. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
Yesterday on the show, we were talking about what the Bible says, the New Testament in particular, what it has to say about the Passover observance. I read through 1 Corinthians 5. This is verses 7 and 8, where it says, "Purge out, therefore, the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened. For even Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us." So Christ, he is our Passover. He is that lamb sacrifice, the Lamb of God, referred to in the Gospel of John, all through the book of Revelation, the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And all that ancient Israel went through in the lead up to that Passover in Exodus 12 and every year thereafter, slaughtering all of those little lambs, tens of thousands of them. And that all pointing to the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But what's worth noting here with respect to 1 Corinthians is that this is 2 decades or so after the crucifixion. And here the Apostle Paul is talking to Gentiles that had come into the church from in and around Corinth, people that had no familiarity at all whatsoever with Christianity, not even Judaism. So they didn't come out of the Jewish religion. They weren't Christian, they were just Gentiles that were steeped in pagan traditions and observances. And here is the Apostle Paul commanding these Christians, Gentiles that had converted to the truth, Gentiles that had become true Christians, and here is the Apostle Paul in the mid-50s AD giving them instructions regarding the Passover ceremony. some of them had began to treat it like a pagan festival where there was more of a party spirit as opposed to, you know, coming to the Passover with an understanding of just how solemn the occasion is. It's a memorial of that final agony and beating and scourging and crucifixion of Jesus Christ. It's a memorial service. And Paul here is telling the Corinthian people how to keep it, how to observe it. And he talks in those two verses I just gave to you about not only the Passover, but also keeping the days of unleavened bread. That too is mentioned in Acts 20 and verse 6. You can just look at some of these verses later. But to stay in 1 Corinthians, notice chapter 11. Here, Paul really gets into the specifics of the Passover ceremony and those symbols that Jesus Christ had changed, or in the case of the foot washing, had added. And all that, you can find it in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, of course. John 13 speaks of the foot washing ordinance. Verse 23 here in 1 Corinthians 11, it says, "For I have received of the Eternal that which also I delivered unto you, that the Eternal Jesus, the Lord Jesus, the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks or prayed over it, he broke it and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you.'" And so 1 Peter 2 and Isaiah 53 speak of the stripes of Jesus Christ, by whose stripes we are healed. So he withstood this beating where his body was just shredded, ripped to shreds. "Broken for you," it says, "this do in remembrance of me." And after the same manner also he took the cup, and when he had supped, saying, "This cup is the New Testament in my blood. This do you, as often as you drink it, in remembrance of me." I mean, do this every year in remembrance of me, said Jesus. "For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you do show the Lord's death till he come. Wherefore, whosoever shall eat this bread and drink this cup of the Eternal unworthily," or in an unworthy manner, with a wrong attitude. And see, some of them had a wrong attitude with respect to this ceremony. It says, "shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Eternal. But let a man examine himself," it says in verse 28, "and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup." And so Paul is instructing these Christians, these true Christians in this Gentile area, Corinth, he's telling them how to keep the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and to do it according to God's instructions, to take it very, very seriously. I mean, part of the process going in is to examine yourself, but especially, as my father brings out in the Overcomer booklet, to especially examine yourself in relation to that lamb sacrifice. Focus on the Lamb. You can read more about that in this booklet. This booklet, How to Be an Overcomer. I also mentioned this one yesterday, by the way. Pagan holidays or God's holy days. Which? Which ones are biblical? Which ones did Jesus observe? I mean, that's something that we should seriously consider. Here was Paul giving them instructions on how to keep and observe the Passover. And this is in the mid-50s AD, some 20 to 25 years after the crucifixion. Jesus himself, he said in Luke 22, "This do in remembrance of me." You've got to do this to remember. And that's what the Passover ceremony is. It's a memorial service, as I said. A memorial service of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And so why wouldn't everyone want to do this? Or certainly everyone who considers themselves to be Christian, why wouldn't they want to do this? Why wouldn't they want to observe this? Because you do hear a lot in traditional Christianity about the sacrifice of Christ. And so here's a memorial service about that sacrifice. And yet virtually everyone in the world of traditional Christianity, they view this service as something that's just, I guess, distinctly Jewish. And of course, the Jews don't observe it the way that the way that it's explained in the Gospels and in 1 Corinthians. They, of course, rejected Jesus Christ as the Messiah and persecuted him and wanted him to be crucified. What happened? What happened between the time of the Passover observance in Corinth in the mid-50s AD and today? What happened between that period and today? If you just look at the first century church and then compare it to the churches of this world, the traditional Christian churches of this world, why are they so far removed from what Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 11? Why do they view the Passover as Jewish? And the Jews, as I say, they still keep a form of Passover, but it's not like what's described in Luke 22 or John 13 or 1 Corinthians 11. Well, the Apostle Paul, as you know, some of you, he was persecuted even unto death. He was executed in the mid-60s A.D. John, he lived until the mid-90s or so. The one who wrote the book of John and the epistles of John. And so after this, I mean, it was the Bible does prophesy of seven church eras that would continue right up until the return of Christ, and how that the church, God's church, would never die out. But let me just give you some history now as I transition over to what's covered in this book. And this is a powerful book, The True History of God's True Church. And I don't want to inundate you with all these reading assignments, but if you got these three, the Overcomer booklet, the Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days booklet, and then this one, so much packed into it, about church history. What happened after Paul wrote 1 Corinthians 11, telling the brethren of God how to observe the Passover? What happened after that? Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, he said this in Mystery of the Ages. Sometime during the early decades of the second century, the baton was passed from the Ephesian era to the people that God had called to the Smyrna era of his church. This is recorded in Revelation 2, these church eras, the first one being Ephesus, the second one Smyrna. It says, powerless, often persecuted, and rejected as heretics, the world lost sight of them. So as I say, Jesus said that the true church would never die. You can see that in Matthew 16 and verse 18. You can look at Matthew 10 and see where Jesus referred to the true church as a little flock. Not a massive universal organization or system, but a tiny little flock. After those original apostles died off, I mentioned Paul's execution in the 60s. The Apostle John, he died in the 90s, and he handed the baton over to an individual named Polycarp. And again, you can look at some of this history of the true church as it continued after what's recorded, what we know, obviously, there in the New Testament, the first century church. What's happened, though, in the 2,000 years since? Where is God's church today? And why do so many traditional Christian denominations ignore or dismiss or shove aside these instructions in 1 Corinthians 11 and elsewhere, or pretend that Easter and some of these other holidays are biblical when they're not? Easter, in the King James Version of the Bible, it is mentioned in Acts 12 and verse 4, I believe it is, but commentators know it's a gross mistranslation. You can look at the Greek word, and it's referring to Passover. So even translators, they tried to corrupt the New Testament record by inserting a holiday into the mix, when in fact it's not mentioned anywhere as being observed by the first century Christians. It's the same with Christmas, as we know. It says here, this is from, what is this from? Oh, this is from our book. The True History of God's True Church. My father says here, perhaps the most important event in Polycarp's ministry, he was the one that took the baton on from the Apostle John on into the second century. Perhaps the most important event in Polycarp's ministry was his battle to preserve the Passover. That's what my father writes in this book. It says further on, the churches in the West had established Easter Sunday as the memorial for Christ's resurrection. They stopped keeping the Passover. God's church in the East continued the custom of observing Passover at night using the new symbols of bread and wine. You see, just like Jesus told the disciples the night before he was crucified, just like Paul explained in 1 Corinthians 11, this is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. It says, there is no indication of the observance of the Easter festival in the New Testament or in the writings of the Apostolic Fathers. That's not our literature. That's not a quote from our book. Now, it might be included in this, the quote. This is the Encyclopedia Britannica. The Encyclopedia Britannica. There is no indication of the observance of the Easter festival in the New Testament or in the writings of the Apostolic Fathers. It's nowhere in there. It's nowhere discussed. The real origins of Easter, it goes back to a pagan goddess associated with the rising of the sun, day, spring, fertility. This is why they have the bunnies and the eggs as part of the tradition. It's not connected to Scripture in any way. It says here, the first Christians, this is the Britannica again, the first Christians continued to observe the Jewish festivals, though in a new spirit, as commemorations of events which these festivals had foreshadowed. Thus, the Passover, with a new conception added to it of Christ as the true Paschal Lamb, and the first fruits from the dead continued to be observed. So, I mean, the Britannica, like some of these other older sources, point to it as being, you know, something that was Jewish. You know, the first Christians, they kept keeping the Jewish festival. But it wasn't, the Jews weren't even observing it the right way in the first century. This, Jesus started the Christian church, right? He's the head of the church. We are the body of Christ. We in the church, 1 Corinthians 12. And so what Jesus was establishing there in that final Passover, whether you look at Luke 22 or one of the other gospel accounts, what Paul picked up on later, what Jesus established was Christian. That's what we're reading about in the New Testament. It's not a Jewish observance. The Jews have a certain observance around Passover. As I said yesterday, they've blended Passover together with the days of unleavened bread, and they call the entire 7 days Passover. But the Bible, as Paul does in 1 Corinthians, the Bible describes them as two separate festivals that do occur close together. The Passover coming on the 14th day of the sacred calendar, the first month in the sacred calendar, and then the night to be much observed, which basically kicks off the days of unleavened bread. That happens the following night. Well, there's lots of other history. The Quarto Decimum controversy, it's talked about in here. And again, it takes you back. This true history of the true church takes you back to those early centuries, the first century that's discussed in the New Testament, but then the second, third, and fourth century, and you see how the truth of God was blotted out. This is the same strategy over and again coming from the devil. Just try to wipe it out. Just try to wipe out the people of God entirely. There's a lot more that we could get to. I'll just, again, here at the close of the show, refer you to these publications and our toll-free number, 1-866-930-3024. You are listening or viewing to, you're watching the Trumpet Daily program, and I'm your host, Stephen Fleury, and we certainly appreciate you joining us on today's show, and we'll see you again tomorrow.